The first recorded war in history was inscribed on a Sumerian carving depicting a battle between two Mesopotamia city-states, Sumer and Elam. We're talking like before 2500 BC under the King of Kish, and it was recorded that they carried away as spoils the weapons of Elam. This was the first recorded war. Obviously, not the first conflict in human history, as we have a tendency to fight each other through the test of time. The same could be said about professional football. The guest on this week's episode talks of a team that is currently the oldest franchise in NFL history. But that doesn't mean that it was the first professional football franchise of all time. So sit back and let's listen to an interview with Joe Ziamba.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is October 15th, 1899, and we have a special guest riding shotgun with us again. His name is Joe Ziamba, the preeminent source of Chicago Cardinal gridiron knowledge nuggets. Now, this dude has dedicated a large portion of his life to researching and educating fans about the rich history of the NFL's oldest franchise. Joe has written two books about football. The first is called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL. And the second is titled Cadets, Cannons, and Legends, The Football History of Morgan Park Military Academy. And I'll go ahead and leave links to these books and other information about Joe on the website, which you can get to by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com/Joe Ziamba. That's Joe Ziemba. Joe Ziamba. Now, Joe has a wealth of knowledge on the founding of the Cardinals and also the NFL. He's often a resource for articles and is invited to speak regularly across the nation. Now, listening to Joe, you can truly hear the passion he has for the game. But let me not take you to a point where you have to wait any longer, because I present to you the extremely knowledgeable Joe Ziamba. Joe, we just stepped off the DeLorean, and the date is October 15th, 1899. Now, why is that date so important to us?
This date is kind of one of the best hidden secrets in the history of the National Football League and any professional football game. This is when the team that we know now as the Cardinals played their first game in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. They were then known as the Morgan Athletic Association, and they defeated a team called the Shermans in what one of the papers called a lopsided game by a score of 20-0.
Cardinals, Chicago. What are you talking about? There's no Chicago Cardinals.
Yeah, one time, the team that we now know as the Arizona Cardinals started in Chicago back in 1899, and we trace the heritage of that team to a guy named Chris O'Brien, who, at the time of this first game in 1899, was the left end for the Morgan Athletic Association. That team evolved the next year into the Morgan Athletic Club, which is a little more formal of a team, and then eventually became known as the Racine Cardinals. The Cardinals name came from a social and athletic club that Chris O'Brien and his brother started. And Racine came from the street that Chris O'Brien lived on the south side of Chicago. And finally, and after the league started itself in 1920, there was a Racine, Wisconsin Cardinals team as well that was mistaken for the Chicago Cardinals. And so Chris O'Brien changed the name to the Chicago Cardinals in 1920.
So then you mentioned 1920, the beginning and the founding of the NFL. Does that mean that the Racine Chicago Cardinals had a play in that?
They did. And Chris O'Brien, again, one of our forgotten heroes, he and George Hollis of the Decatur Staleys were at that organizational meeting. And Chris O'Brien was one of the founders of what we now know as the National Football League back in 1920. He wasn't as well-funded as some of the teams. Pro football, as we know now, was still pretty well disorganized. There were roster changes throughout the season. Schedules were made perhaps a week in advance. And there were a lot of small-town teams for example, in Moline, Illinois, or Rock Island, Illinois, and Pine Village in Indiana. Teams that were around right around the start of the National Football League, and some, such as the Hammond, Indiana Pros, were part of that first unit of teams back in 1920.
How do you know so much about the early history of football?
It came by accident, really. When I was growing up, my dad was a football coach. He never talked much about his career as a player, but he was an All-American player and end at a little school called St. Benedict's in Atchison, Kansas. And from there, he went into coaching. But when he passed away many years ago, he had a box of material that he had saved, or his parents had saved, where we found out that he was actually a draft choice of the Cardinals in the 40s, and he went to training camp. And what I wanted to do was find out what happened after that. I know he had a bad knee, and he decided that he could make more money coaching high school football than he could playing professional football, believe it or not. But his contract, which I still have, he got paid $110 a game, and the Cardinals players back then had to provide their own shoes and shoulder pads. So we don't see the million-dollar contracts back then that we see today. And he decided in training camp that when he got his knee hurt that, yeah, he was going to hang up the cleats, so to speak, and become a coach, which he did. I was able to find out that he likely did make the team. There was a couple of programs out that had 32 players on it, and he was included in that. But by then, he had decided to get into coaching. But during my search for information about my dad, I also found out that there wasn't too much information about the Cardinals themselves, when the team started. I wanted to know more about when the NFL started. And so that began kind of a long 7-year search from the time I started researching. I had no idea that I was ever going to publish a book about it, but we did have a book come out called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL. And, my original intent was just to find out what happened to him. Then I thought, well, maybe I'll write about their last championship in 1947. But as I went farther and farther back and found out that the history sometimes was a little misconstrued, and there are reasons for that, I was interested in finding out exactly when the Cardinals started. And it wasn't really easy, because when I started this over 20 years ago, we didn't have the access online that we do today to some of the resources. So it took a lot of rolls of microfilm going through old newspapers from the 1890s and early 1900s to find what I was looking for in terms of the history of the Cardinals team.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I was curious about. Like, how does one, even back then, now it's a little bit easier with the internet, but you can't really trust all your sources. How does somebody go through all that with this knowledge and information that I don't even know if it's there? Like we talked about at the beginning of the episode, the first ever documented war in history, and that's 2500 BC. And now we're talking about this professional football team from 1899. It just baffles me that you're able to get information at the same time. How is there not enough information out there for a professional football team?
Yeah, and one of the things that I found was a real detriment was the Cardinals, as well as the Chicago Bears, both had fires at their storage facilities or their offices sometime in the 40s or 50s. I'm not sure when. And so a lot of that early Cardinals stuff was missing. And some of the history that did survive, it was the majority of it was from the team itself. And I found that a lot of that information is erroneous and could trace it now. And this is still an ongoing search. I wanted to find out what some of the erroneous information was. For example, if you look at the Cardinals website or even the Hall of Fame website, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, it says the Cardinals started in 1898 and the owner was Chris O'Brien. And I was not able to document 1898 or a Morgan Athletic Club at that time. And so there's little pieces here and there of the puzzle. For example, I did find out Chris O'Brien was only 17 or 18 years old. He certainly wasn't the owner of the team. I was able to find this first game in a little tiny newspaper called the Chicago Southside Sun. And this was kind of a challenge in itself, because newspapers at that time, now we can kind of hold them in our hands and look at them easily. Back then they were, I guess they called broadsides, very tall newspapers and really tiny 6 or 8 point print where they didn't have a separate sports page. So you'd have to go through every one of these numerous columns to see if there's any mention of a football team. And when we found this first game that we talked about with the Morgan Athletic Association and the Shermans, it did mention that Chris O'Brien and his brother were on the team, Pat O'Brien. They were the two people who really we can trace the heritage of the Cardinals back to. So it was just finding little things that didn't make sense when you go back and literally search for it and maybe find something that kind of contradicts the history that is published as we now know it. But I understand why the stuff is published, because I'm a knucklehead that goes back and loves looking for things like this, where if you look up in a website and it said, yeah, here's when the Cardinals started, of course you're going to believe it. And it really doesn't matter in the world if the Cardinals started 1898 or 1899, but I think a lot of us that are involved in researching professional football, it was kind of a major victory for myself. I think kind of I compared it one time to, oh, this is going to sound crazy, but the guy who found the Titanic, finally, here I was. I found the first game of the Cardinals.
Right, so yeah.
Made me happy.
No, I mean, that's just the same thing with, we continue to find new information with archaeological digs, or like you said, Titanic, or any other type of historical data that previously was unknown. And I mean, I'm wondering if you would ever continue on your research and go back and maybe find something before 1899.
Yeah, I've started looking a little bit, going back to say the early 1890s, and there have been some instances of other professional teams, at least playing in the Chicago area. And again, with access now on the internet, we can go back and see how organized professional football might have been going even back before then. And I give a real tip of the hat to the Professional Football Researchers Association, which has a lot of people who enjoy reading and going back and finding some of this stuff out. So that's also been a big help to see what other people have done as well.
Yeah, I use their website quite frequently as far as my research goes, and I believe that, you know, to the best of their abilities, they're going to have the right information on there. And an article I saw on a website there with you, you mentioned Chris O'Brien in an interview, I believe it was, with how he was the first to print game programs and marketing deals. Is that what I saw?
It was. And he was a unique individual. As I mentioned, he was with the team as a player, and he continued to coach, and then, as we call, a manager, and be a fundraiser for the team. But when the team got to the what we now know as the NFL, he did a couple of unique things. First, he was honoring the veterans from World War I at games. He would allow them to come in and sit at the game for free. He opened up the first parking lot that I know of at Normal Park Stadium on the south side of Chicago, so people could take these newfangled automobiles and drive to the game if they wanted to. And then he developed programs where he would not only have information on his own team, but also information on what's going on around the league. So he really was a valuable promoter. I'm not saying he was the first one to ever do a program. They've been around. But he was one that really tried to promote the Cardinals to the best of his ability back then.
Do you think that the promotion helped keep the team alive, or do you think it would have survived no matter what?
Yeah, it was absolutely helped him to survive, because here was one guy, and he didn't finance the team himself. He had a group of investors, and when the team incorporated for the first time in 1917, it had a very strange name, and I can't make this up, but it was called the Racine Cardinals Social and Pleasure Club. And in the incorporation papers I was able to get from the state of Illinois, it said, yes, their goal is to provide activities for young people in the neighborhood, and also to put on sporting events such as football. But Chris was attuned to the different newspapers. There were several newspapers in Chicago, and he always managed to get a quote in the paper to help push that team and maybe attract people to the gate. And he would travel to different locations before the game, kind of a predecessor of a PR man, to tell these local papers about his team and how tough they were going to be. And they probably didn't match up to the local team from Rock Island, but they sure as heck were going to try. And that was one of the things that Chris was very good at, was the promotion of his beloved Cardinals.
How much credit does he get in the annals or the history of the league anywhere?
In my opinion, not enough. And I've always called him the forgotten hero of the NFL. He and George Halas were at the same level at one time. And of course, Halas, with the success of the Bears, is one that we really revere for what he has done for the league, and rightly so. Of course, Halas stayed with the team throughout his entire life, where Chris O'Brien could not take it financially and eventually sold the team around 1929 in Chicago. And that's another ironic thing. He sold the team for $12,500. It's now worth $2.3 billion, according to Forbes magazine.
Wow. So. Yeah, speaking of the Bears, what did the rivalry look like at the beginning? Two teams in the, well, the Bears didn't start in Chicago, but how did that look like at the beginning of the NFL?
At first, it was very friendly. When the Bears started playing their first games in Chicago, they were still the Decatur Staleys till they moved in 1921. But the two teams would meet twice a year, and it was really good for attendance. Cardinals still playing at Normal Park, or eventually moving to Comiskey Park, which was the home of the Chicago White Sox baseball team. And the Bears were playing at Wrigley Field, home of the Cubs. In 1921 or so, George Halas tried to steal the star of the Cardinals, a guy named Paddy Driscoll, P-A-D-D-Y, who played at Northwestern. And he and George Halas were part of the Great Lakes Naval team, a football team that won the Rose Bowl in 1919. And then they were teammates in late 1919 of the Hammond Pros. And Paddy was really a gifted halfback. An incredibly accurate drop kicker who at one time held the NFL record for field goal distance, I think over 50 yards. And George Halas made an offer to Paddy Driscoll to become a shareholder or an owner of the Bears. And Dutch Sterneman was the other partner with Halas. So the three of them were going to be the owners of the Bears. The NFL stepped in, however, and it was one of the first cases of tampering, where they told George Halas, and we can read that in the league minutes, to stay away from Paddy Driscoll. He's a property, so to speak, of the Chicago Cardinals. And I'm not sure if that's what kicked off the intensity of the rivalry, but the very next season of 1922 was one of the finest examples of how the rivalry kind of got out of hand. And in that game, the Sterneman and Halas were kind of keying on Paddy Driscoll as he ran around the right end, and they physically picked him up, threw him to the ground. And Paddy was somewhat incoherent. He was might have been what we might call a concussion today. He should have been in the protocol, but he got up and started swinging, and he knocked Sterneman out. This is from some newspaper reports. And then a large fight broke out, and we soon had people from the stands, players, mounted policemen trying to break up this riot on the field. And it turns out that Ed Healy, who the week before was still considered the first free agent in pro football, he was signed by Halas from the Rock Island team, I believe it was, for $100 a game. And he later recalled in some published reports, "Here I am sitting out here for $100 a game, and all of a sudden, out of the bleachers comes the Southside Rooters," he called them, "with pistols on their belts." And he called them that Al Capone mob out there to protect their beloved Cardinals. So that was a little bit of the gangsters getting involved at the time. Halas, in his autobiography, says that when he kind of was at the end of the fight, whether he was knocked out as well, that someone had straddled him and put a pistol behind his ear. But in the end, Halas said in his autobiography, it was a fun game. Cardinals won 6-0, but Halas said, "We all had a really good time." So that was the start of the rivalry between the two teams.
Wow, they had gangsters on the field?
Yes.
Capone's guys?
Yeah, according to Ed Healy.
And you said you found that in a newspaper article somewhere?
Yeah, and I think it's been in a book, too, and it was pretty common, although people didn't talk much about who was at the games way back when, but Cardinals were the South Side team, as the White Sox were, and the Bears and the Cubs were from the North Side. So there's that natural rivalry within the city of Chicago that got quite heated at times. And so many newspaper articles would talk about fights. Even later in the 40s and 50s, Ed Sprinkle of the Bears, called the meanest man in football, got in a fight with Charlie Trippi of the Cardinals, and Trippi apparently knocked Sprinkle out. And he was mad he got kicked out of the game because he had got punched earlier by somebody else. And of course, we hear the old stories of stuff going on under the tackle pile of bitten fingers and kicks and scratches, etc. But kind of the owners participated in that a little bit as well. One of the things that the Cardinals would say later about George Halas, we've heard that old story about Halas being so tight that he throws nickels around like they're manhole covers. And one of the Cardinals had told me one time that the home team, this time being the Bears, when the Cardinals went up there, the home team is supposed to provide a post-game meal for the visitors. And they said Halas was so tight with his wallet that when they got in the locker room for their post-game meal, there were two loaves of bread and a couple of pounds of bologna for the entire team. So that fired the Cardinals up for their next game with the Bears.
Oh, I'm sure it did. And you mentioned the north side and the south side, but where did the Chicago Tigers come into play in all this?
Oh, yeah. The Chicago Tigers were another team that started in 1920. They played in Wrigley Field before the Bears arrived into town. It was a pretty good team. They had some Notre Dame players that were the stars for the Tigers, and the team only lasted a year. It's supposed to be a story that the Cardinals and the Tigers played, and the winner in 1920 would be the one who would remain in Chicago. I could find no proof for that. In fact, I think a lot of writers have said that story simply didn't exist, and many of these stories showed up after Chris O'Brien passed away from the PR guy of the Cardinals. But yeah, the Tigers were a decent team. They played several games in 1920 and did fairly well.
It'd be nice to see, even though if that wasn't true, the legend, you know, go back and watch a movie, you know, you win or get out kind of game and just the final countdown. Speaking of the win or get out and, you know, success in the NFL, when was the first championship for the Cardinals?
Well, the first championship was in 1925. Very controversial year, as you may know. Back then, teams did not have a set schedule, and so they could play as many games as they wanted until a certain deadline day, which around that time was early in December. And Pottsville Maroons out of Pennsylvania had a great team. They defeated the Cardinals late in the season. A lot of the newspapers said that was for the championship of the league. The Cardinals, though, scheduled a couple of more games, which they were allowed to. And they won both games fairly easily. So percentage-wise, they had a better record than Pottsville. The stories get even a little crazier because Pottsville then was asked, I guess, removed from the league because they played an unsanctioned game and in a territory that was not theirs. The Cardinals were fined later because in one of those games that they scheduled late in the season with the Milwaukee Badgers, Milwaukee came to town, didn't have enough players. So one of the Cardinal players recruited four high school players to fill out the roster. And again, the NFL way back then. So as it goes, the Cardinals in the record book still shows them as the best record and the champions of 1925, although the people in Pottsville probably have a pretty strong argument. But again, we can't change what happened way back then. That was history and rules were set. Chris O'Brien was fined. The player who was responsible for bringing in the high school players, he was banned for life, and then Pottsville was dropped from the league. Chris O'Brien's fine was later rescinded. Pottsville was later back in the league, so it was a decision made by the league at the time. But the Cardinals are noted as the 1925 champions.
Yeah, just totally different time nowadays. We couldn't even fathom a record, let alone being able to play against other leagues. I mean, it'd be like the NFL, I don't know, my Detroit Lions wanting to get a victory and going to play against the CFL or something like that to pad their stats. Another thing that kind of around about that time, there was one of the most famous athletes in the world, the 20th century, that is, Jim Thorpe. And I saw that he played for the team at one point.
He did. And yeah, Jim Thorpe, played for the Cardinals in 1928. Chris O'Brien, again, that master of public relations, was looking for a way to boost the gate. I believe it was against the Bears on Thanksgiving Day. And so he was able to get a hold of Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe, maybe, we're not sure of his exact birth date. He was 40 or 42 years old, and the brief newspaper account said that he was pretty bulky, played only briefly, maybe brought a few people in, but since he was in a Cardinals uniform for one day, and that was the last time he ever played an NFL game, he's still on the all-time roster as being a member of the Cardinals. A week or two before, he also played a game for the Hammond team. I believe it was the Hammond Pros at that time as well. But yeah, so Jim Thorpe was getting around kind of a hired gun, going where he might be needed or where they might need some help at the gate to boost the gate and attract people to attend the games.
Kind of like the modern-day Josh McCown, even though he's not as big right. of a name.
Exactly.
You spoke of Thanksgiving. There was another special moment the year later, wasn't there, with Record?
There was a year later, and every year the Cardinals and the Bears played on Thanksgiving Day, switching off which stadium they would be at. The Bears had gotten the best of it in the mid-20s. Their team was stronger. In 1929, when the Cardinals played the Bears, they had a guy named Ernie Nevers, one of the first Pro Football Hall of Famers. He had started out with the Duluth Eskimos, another unique team that didn't really play any home games but traveled a lot. Nevers was supposedly so tough that one time he played a game, I think it was in college, on two broken ankles. We're not sure if that's accurate or not, but that's how these legends start. But anyway, when the Bears and the Cardinals met in 1929 on Thanksgiving Day, Ernie Nevers scored all 40 points, and the Cardinals defeated the Bears 40-6. And to my knowledge, that's still the longest or oldest individual record in the NFL, is one player scoring 40 points. Gale Sayers of the Bears scored 36 back in the mid-60s, I think it was 66. But Nevers was also the kicker of the Cardinals, and so he added four extra points to go along with his six touchdowns for 40 points. We're not sure if that record will ever be approached, but it remains with Ernie Nevers to this day.
Yeah, just imagine if there was fantasy football back then, how good he would have been.
Oh, absolutely.
Did he have, what was his career like, or even that season, or was that more of a one-shot bright spot?
He was one of those guys that you might think upon as fairly indestructible. We don't have great statistics from when he played. But yeah, he was a great running back because he was one like to initiate contact when he was running. He had some speed, and of course, he was a great kicker as well. So he never approached that 40, but the week before, he had scored all 19 points when the Cardinals had a game. So he scored 59 points in a row for the team there in 1929. So he was pretty much their offensive focus at the time.
Right, yeah. Sounds like he was a one-man show, a one-man wrecking crew.
And he had great blocking from a guy named Duke Slater. And again, here's again my opinion, one man who should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame is Duke Slater, who went to the University of Iowa and then played with the Cardinals. A phenomenal lineman and just a really strong person. Later became a judge in Chicago. And ironically, when Normal Park, where the Cardinals played in the 20s, was torn down in 1950 or 51 and became a courtroom and a police station, Duke Slater was a judge in Chicago, and he operated out of that office on the same area where the football stadium once stood.
That's another one of those stories that you just can't make up.
Exactly, yes.
That's, I never even heard of the name Duke Slater. Talk about a perfect football name.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
You mentioned that the stats were hard to come by. I mean, how accurate do you think some of the individual statistics were from? Maybe I should ask it this way. When do you think that individual statistics and team statistics maybe became a little bit more accurate, where we could rely on them nowadays?
Oh, good point. Yeah, I think in the 20s and 30s, we would start to see expanded game reports. But there wouldn't be, it would say who scored a touchdown or who passed for it. Maybe in the story, the passing yardage, but very rarely the statistics. However, the Green Bay Gazette did a tremendous job of outlining pretty much every play and including statistics for their team and the opposition that came in. And whether it was the fact that pro football wasn't as popular as it is now, but certainly maybe by the 40s, when we first, at the end of the 40s, we started seeing television come into play. And in the 50s, I think people took more of an interest in other aspects, much like they did before with baseball batting averages or earned run average. Now they want to know how many yards such and such gathered. The newspapers simply didn't cover it, and then teams like the Cardinals or the Bears, who lost a lot of their records, just didn't have those individual statistics to lean on. So definitely by the time the television age broke in the late 50s, a little bit before then. But before then, it was kind of hit and miss. We have some guesses. You could try and build it by searching different newspapers or sources in the 40s or 30s. But a lot of times, you just can't rely on their accuracy. You hope they're correct. It wasn't until we could actually get those game box scores or line scores in place to really get an idea of accurate statistics for the teams.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays, of course, we have fantasy football, so it's there's a different perspective and reason why fans are so fascinated with individual statistics. I just wonder why and how people got to the point where they cared so much about individual statistics as opposed to just who won the game and what was that driving factor.
Yeah, and it might have, another reason was difficult to get statistics in the early days is that some teams perhaps did not have numbers on their back. And the fields were often really brutal, might just be mud instead of grass without proper line markers. They had to guess for how many yards, but it may have had something with pro football. And we even see in the early days, there were bets on games. I shouldn't say that, should I? But even the players themselves in the 20s, that's how they made their money, was betting on their own selves, their own teams, or taking bets with the fans or passing the hat. Before we had television revenue and radio revenue, et cetera, personal advertisements and promotions, the teams relied solely on the attendance to bring money in and the sale of their program. So perhaps later as it got on, people wanted to know more about the teams. But even in the colleges, we didn't see all that much in terms of game statistics. Just the perhaps the top performers of a game. And if they weren't a top performer of the next game, we might miss their statistics.
How many fans typically would show up to a game in the 20s and 30s for the Cardinals?
Attendance was fairly low. I would say maybe 5,000 for average. We now have some additional information aside from the newspapers, which probably guesstimated how many people were at a game. We saw recently in a game in 1920 that the Chicago Tribune said there were 10,000 people at a Cardinals game. But at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, the family of Dutch Sterneman, as I mentioned earlier, he was the co-owner of the Bears with Halas until about 1931 or 32, and he kept a lot of great financial records that we now have the ability to check on. And one of the fun things is to see exactly how many people were at a Bears game at Wrigley Field. And there was a game, I think, against Columbus, Ohio, and 1,500 people were at Wrigley Field. Once Red Grange came upon the scene in the NFL, those crowds grew from 30 to 70,000 for a while during his initial tour. But I would say back to your original question, probably 5,000 would be about an average. A normal park held about that many people. It was a baseball field, really, that Chris O'Brien made into a football gridiron by having the field go from the first base dugout all the way out to the left field fence. There's just enough room to put a football, 100-yard football field in there. So, but that was probably the best they could do with attendance. And in the 30s, the Cardinals were so frustrated by attendance, and a lot of people don't know this, they actually moved to Wrigley Field and shared Wrigley Field with the Bears from 1931 through 1939.
So then did that really improve their attendance, do you think, or did it just make the stadium look even more empty because it was bigger?
I think probably made the stadium look bigger. When they're up at Wrigley Field, their fans felt really betrayed. Why should we go up to the north side? In fact, I think it was Vince Benonis, one of the linemen for the Cardinals, said at the time that, you know, we moved up to Wrigley Field, but rich people up there didn't want to come see us, and our fans didn't want to come up to see us, so we were left with a lot of empty seats, to which the fans then that were loyal were anxious to see the Cardinals play and amuse themselves by trying to irritate the other players or setting fire to the bleachers.
Oh, man.
Fun-loving kids back then.
Wow, yeah. And it's not like they had TV or anything like that in the 20s and 30s where they could just watch it from at home. I mean, it was either go to the game or not.
Correct.
Wasn't there a... was it the Chicago Cardinals and the Bears that played during the time of when the Pearl Harbor attacks happened, or was it a different teams that played? Well, there you go. Many of the Chicago Cardinals fans were not happy that their South Side team betrayed them and started playing north at Wrigley Field. But nonetheless, this episode ends about halfway through the interview with Josiemba. And I hope you enjoyed this interview so far and were able to gain some of those gridiron knowledge nuggets that we all seek for about the early days of the NFL and the NFL's oldest franchise. As a reminder, you can get the links to the books of Joe and the bio of him over at the dedicated site on the website over at thefootballhistorydude.com/Joe Ziemba. Again, that's Joe Ziemba. Also, if you enjoyed this show, I got a mission for you. Why don't you go ahead and take and tell one more football geek like yourself about the show and send them over to thefootballhistorydude.com. Next week, we're going to finish this interview of Joe Ziemba to learn what happened with the Cardinals after the Pearl Harbor bombings. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.